from KALW News in San Francisco. This is Cross Currents, context, culture, and connection from around the Bay Area.
I'm from Richmond in East Bay.
Terry Hills Pinole.
Dolores at Market Street.
Daly City.
Outer Sunset.
Castro and Church.
Edge of the Mission.
Yachtown. Antioch.
Nopa, San Francisco.
Coming up, in today's gig economy, freelancing is the new normal.
You're a freelancer, you're the boss, but you're also in charge of your financial future.
We'll hear how smartphone apps drive this economy.
You know, you might be crafting on Etsy and renting your spare room on Airbnb.
Then we'll ask what responsibility policymakers have to protect this new workforce.
If you are discriminated against because of race or sex, too bad, because you're not an employee.
And we'll talk to some of the oldest gig workers around.
I'm just hustling, trying to make a living playing music, you know.
Today on Cross Currents, let's get to work. Instead of working just one job for a single employer, more and more of us are becoming gig workers, people who consult, freelance, contract, temp, and do jobs on call. The number of Americans with these alternative work arrangements has been growing steadily over the last 10 years. So what does that mean? It's what we're exploring today. Over the last few years, mobile apps have made it possible to juggle multiple gigs. You can deliver groceries, walk dogs, chauffeur people around, all in one workday. But this new kind of freedom comes at a cost. Most gig workers are considered independent contractors, and that means they're responsible for taking care of a lot of social benefits others take for granted. Things like paying their own taxes, social security, and health insurance.
It's one of the oldest tricks in the book to try to deny that you are the employer of your workers and thereby saving a huge amount on labor costs.
Shannon Liss Reardon is a lawyer who's been representing gig workers for nearly 20 years. Right now, she's advocating specifically for Uber drivers. In this story that originally aired on the podcast Life of the Law, reporter Casey Miner looks at what the law can and can't do for gig workers.
The cases Shannon Liss Reardon sees are pretty blatant, obvious situations where employers are trying to get out of obligations and where employees feel they've been wronged. But not everyone who's a contractor feels like they're being exploited. And this is where things get more complicated. Harry Campbell drives for both the car service company Uber and its competitor Lyft, and he runs a blog and a podcast called The Rideshare Guy.
The ride-hail guy or the glorified taxi guy just didn't have the same cachet.
He used to have a day job as an engineer, but when we talked, he'd actually just quit to focus on the rideshare stuff.
Today's actually my first day of real full-time self-employment.
Campbell's fellow drivers are suing both Uber and Lyft right now. The lawyer in the Uber case is, you guessed it, Shannon Liss Reardon. Campbell's not part of the suit, but he says he gets where his fellow drivers are coming from.
So I think it's kind of a double-edged sword. The biggest problem is that basically you're at the mercy of these companies.
But Campbell says the work still has its perks, and he worries that making drivers employees would make the work a lot less appealing.
I mean, if I wanted to go drive right now, I could turn my app on and I could do one ride and then be done for the day. Or I could go drive 12 hours right now if I wanted. I could take a month off or I can work a month straight. And there aren't many jobs in general that allow you to do that.
Yeah, you know, it really wasn't that long ago that a lot of people would see work as an on-off switch, that you either had a job or you didn't.
Dan Lavoie is director of strategy for the Freelancers Union, an advocacy group for independent workers.
It's not an on-off switch, it's a dimmer switch. And you're moving back and forth between, you know, sort of traditional 9-to-5 work with freelance work, sometimes doing both at the same time. You know, you might be crafting on Etsy and renting your spare room on Airbnb and designing websites for some friends and singing in a band all at the same time. And, you know, using all those different streams of income to make the life that you really want.
Lavoie says around 14 million people work this way. And so far, labor law isn't keeping up.
It's changing so fast that, you know, a tweak here and a tweak there just really isn't going to capture the reality of what life is like for this new workforce.
Remember, being a freelancer means the companies you work for don't owe you anything. You're not paid for travel, for investments in equipment, for the time you lose when you get sick. It can make for a very low hourly rate. And if you lose the gig, there's no safety net.
It seems to cry out for the law either to create a new category, which would give these people some protections, particularly the protections of minimum wage and overtime, and some protections under labor law.
This is Wilma Liebman. She was a member of the National Labor Relations Board for nearly 15 years and its chair for 2.5. She saw a lot of clear-cut misclassification cases where companies claimed workers were independent while controlling everything they did. But she also saw these cases that didn't quite fit the mold.
Maybe the rigidity of these classifications is becoming more obvious to some people. So people are talking about a third category.
A third category, something between employee and independent contractor that would acknowledge situations like Harry Campbell's, for example, and build in protections for people like him. One term for this could be dependent contractor. Liebman suggested that in a case she heard where independent newspaper carriers worked primarily for one company. She says there are similar categories in some European countries. Germany has something called an employee-like person.
I think particularly with the concern about inequality, there's going to be a growing attention to how are all these people going to make a sustainable living.
The idea that we might need to think more broadly about employment is starting to make its way into the courts. The judge hearing the Lyft driver lawsuit recently decided that the case should go to trial. In deciding whether drivers are employees or contractors, he said the jury will, quote, be handed a square peg and asked to choose between two round holes.
That story came to us from Casey Miner. It originally aired on the podcast Life of the Law. This is Cross Currents. I'm Julie Kane. Disputes are cropping up left and right between gig workers and the companies they do work for. Policymakers are intervening, but their legal solutions will take years to enact. A new bill in California would allow gig workers to bargain collectively, but legislators won't vote on it until next year. And last week, courts ruled that Uber and Lyft drivers can't file class action lawsuits because drivers signed an arbitration agreement when they were hired. To find out why the law is so slow to adapt, KALW's Hanat Baba talked to William B. Gould IV. He's a Stanford Law Professor Emeritus and the former chairman of the National Labor Relations Board.
What is the gig economy?
Well, the gig economy is an extension of some of the characteristics that went into this independent contractor idea. The idea is that there's flexibility and autonomy in some measure built into the role of both the consumer and the employee. But the concept of an independent contractor is an old one. And the idea of creativity and autonomy is an old one also in the employment relationship. The fact that I can work my own hours, well, there's nothing inconsistent between that and the employment relationship. The fact that I can be more flexible in terms of the time of day I want to work. Again, there's nothing inconsistent. The fact that I'm working for other employers, that my commitment to this particular employer is of indefinite duration. These are all characteristics that in broad terms are associated with the independent contractor status that the companies contend for in the gig economy. But they are very old concepts that are built into so-called traditional employment relationships.
So can we go back then and tell me about what it was like for an independent contractor in decades ago? What would be the main difference between then and now?
Well, the main difference, there really is fundamentally no difference between then and now. It's just that there are a number of new features that have come about through this. I mean, the main difference is, you know, are you doing work which is essential to that particular employer? Those, they're driving cars. Well, that's the work of Uber and Lyft, and that argues for employee status. I, on the other hand, as a law professor, I may write an op-ed piece for a newspaper. Well, the newspaper, there's nothing inherently connected between my op-ed piece, and as much as I would like it to be, and the newspaper itself. I'm truly an independent contractor.
Can you tell me about the moments of historically the litigation or the attempts at creating new laws or making change, and how come they didn't work?
The states have become more active in recent years. You may know that, for instance, Seattle has enacted an ordinance in the city which promotes collective bargaining for independent contractors. They've said, we don't want to go through this long litigation. And you may know that right now there's considerable litigation right here in San Francisco involving Uber, involving Lyft. There are legal obstacles in connection with that legislation.
What are they?
And that is antitrust law. Because given the fact that independent contractors are not regarded as employees, they are regarded as business people. And business people cannot, under antitrust law, collude for the purpose of setting prices. And the law, in its medieval majesty, has regarded, in many instances, these independent contractors as businessmen.
So what's a gig worker to do between the preemption and the antitrust laws, and they just want to make a living,
yes,
possibly get benefits, possibly organize?
Yes. Well, a number of ideas are being put forward. One is that some of the legislators have said, well, we've got to have a third way. We've got to have a new category of individuals. But that kind of thinking proceeds upon the assumption that the gig economy presents issues which have not been presented before. And I think that that is erroneous. Those issues have always been with us since time immemorial. See, the problem with this so-called third way is nobody can say what the consequences of carving out a unique classification in between employees an independent contractor would be. You see, the companies have it fine right now because they have a workforce that is flexible, and they like to be flexible. I think most of them do. They like to have autonomy, but they don't have the basic protections. If you're discriminated against because of race or sex, too bad, because you're not an employee. If you want to organize into a union, too bad. Or if you want to get unemployment compensation or workers' compensation, no, that's not for you because you're not an employee. I think that it may be that rather than legislation, some of the unions, the Teamsters are playing a particularly leading role in this regard, are going to have to sit down with these companies and find some answers. You see, not only does the government not have an answer in terms of what the consequences would be for a new classification, but also there's no consensus about labor law generally. And if you begin to open this issue up legislatively, you're going to have a Donnybrook of a wide variety of issues that Congress has been struggling with for the past 40 years or so to update our labor laws in other respects. And I think the most straightforward practical answer comes through an attempt by the unions and companies to get together and hammer out practical answers to these questions.
Sounds so gloomy.
I don't mean to be. I don't mean to be gloomy. I think that if we look at this basic framework we have in the industrialized countries, and here in the United States, it's a good one, and we can build on it. You know, it does no good to say that there's a Bill of Rights for workers, and then to deny them effective remedies, deny them effective coverage. And what we have to do as a society, through either government intervention, and I am very much down about government intervention, or through the collective bargaining, which has been a major strength for this country and for much of the West in the past, is to come to grips with the problems we've identified.
That was William B. Gould IV, the former chairman of the National Labor Relations Board. He spoke with KALW's Hanat Baba. Listening to Cross Currents from KALW News, I'm Julie Kane. In that last piece, William B. Gould IV pointed out that freelancing is nothing new. Well, in 1885, musicians in San Francisco organized. They formed the Musicians Union, Local 6. This makes musicians temporary employees of some of the venues where they play. That means they can get union help negotiating their pay and working conditions. But since the 1970s, union membership has been falling. KALW's Shireen Adel tells us why.
This is the Golden Gate Park Band. They play almost every Sunday afternoon at the Spreckles Temple of Music, more commonly known as the Band Show. Musicians come and go, but the band's been around since 1882. Mark Niemoyten has been playing with them for more than 20 years.
I'm a trumpet player, musician, and music teacher.
This is just one of the gigs he takes to make ends meet.
I freelance sometimes with local symphonies. I play with an R&B band. Church jobs, graduations, weddings, anybody will have me.
Our next composer, Girolamo Frescobaldi, was a very influential musician.
Sometimes he's hired as an independent contractor, and sometimes as an employee. For this gig, he's an employee. That's because everyone in this band has to join San Francisco's Musicians Union, Local 6. Dues are $200 a year, and for people like Niemoyten, having regular work is worth the cost of membership.
You know, for a freelance musician, you like to have those steady things that you can count on.
He can earn up to $2,500 a year with this band. And his union dues mean the band pays into a pension fund, keeps track of rehearsal hours, and gives him job security. If he can't make a gig with them, he doesn't lose his job.
They tend to have better working conditions because it's spelled out in the contract.
The problem is, steady union gigs like this are hard to come by. They're usually with bigger groups that have regular seasons, like the symphony, the opera, or the ballet. Competition is steep, and when someone gets a position, they keep it. So for some musicians, being in the union doesn't always pay off.
If I get a gig and I need to be in union, I'll join. But if I don't have any union gigs, I don't think about the union. My name is Anthony Blea, and I'm a professional violinist and teacher. I'm just hustling, trying to make a living playing music, you know.
Blea takes union gigs on occasion. But unlike Niemoyten, he doesn't think keeping up his membership in the union is really worth it. He only does it if the job requires it. Most of the time, he plays non-union gigs. Like the ones he books for his charanga band, Anthony Blea y su charanga.
There needs to be some flexibility because of the types of gigs that any that musicians get, and there's so many types of musicians.
Blea says getting union contracts for his band would be too much trouble.
You would have to pay union wages and, you know, their union rules. So you're going to use union players, you have to abide by those rules. Otherwise, you get fined.
He'd rather set his own rules.
I don't do clubs with that band anymore because there's going to be a cheaper band that will play for any particular club. And I prefer to pay my musicians what they deserve.
Blea looks for jobs that pay at least $100 for 2 hours of music for each musician in his band. That's about the same as the Golden Gate Park band members make per gig. But he doesn't want to deal with all the union's terms and conditions.
You know, you have to have breaks every so often for so many minutes per hour. You know, you have to pay people that carry more than one instrument, you know, stuff like that.
But union contracts vary. The only universal requirements are for musicians to be hired as employees and for their employers to write two checks, one for the band and the other for the pension fund. But a lot of musicians don't know how it works, and some people in the union are working to change that.
I'll play this piece by Massenet. It's called Thais.
Joe Gray is on the board of directors of the Musicians Union, and she also happens to be a volunteer here at KALW. As a musician, she plays the violin with a variety of orchestras.
To give a little bit of background, San Francisco used to have one of the biggest unions in the musicians unions in the country, and every hotel had an orchestra, a band, you know, and dance bands, and it was just really, really thriving, and everything was union.
That's pretty much how it was for the first half of the 20th century. But things started to change in the 1940s. Large orchestras were being replaced by smaller groups, like rock and roll bands and jazz combos. The union was slow to adapt. Black musicians weren't even allowed to join Local 6 until the 1960s. When it came down to it, the union wasn't really representing its community.
So many of them left the union, and the situation today is that in all the bars and clubs that you go into, those musicians are not in the union, and we can't really go in and impose a contract.
The way it works now, union members can take both union and non-union gigs. But if they're hired as independent contractors and something goes wrong, like if a gig is canceled last minute or they don't get compensated for overtime, the union can't do anything to help.
And my particular interest is in trying to address the working conditions of indie musicians who traditionally are not in the musicians' union.
Right now, the most the union can do for non-members is serve as a reference point, a way to learn the lay of the land, and to find out how much other musicians get paid for their work. But Gray wants to do more.
It's standing up for musicians' rights and making sure that they have good working conditions.
The union has some clout with the city, and Gray's been going to meetings with San Francisco's Entertainment Commission. They're the ones that regulate entertainment and nightlife.
They spoke about what a, you know, incredibly successful industry that's happening in San Francisco. Unfortunately, the musicians are the only ones that are not really benefiting.
She's been talking to Entertainment Commission representatives about changing that, like getting special loading zones for equipment or providing affordable rehearsal space. She says there's a lot that can be done. For starters, a census would help everyone get a sense of just how many musicians are working and where.
It's almost as if it's this hidden industry that's under the table, it's not registered, it's not taxed.
But just like other gig workers, you know, people getting work through Uber or TaskRabbit or one of the other apps that are out there, a lot of musicians hold different kinds of jobs. Sometimes taking a low-paying gig is just a way to make a little extra cash.
But it's really undercutting those of us who are trying to make a go of being a professional musician.
And that's always a risk for freelancers and gig workers. If someone is willing to do the same job for less, there's not much anyone can do to stop them. But collectively, if workers wanted a union to represent them, it could make a difference. Here's Mark Nimoyten again.
That's the main benefit, is people banding together and, you know, asking for something that has some teeth. You have something to bargain with. If you're just going in by yourself, you really don't.
It all depends on whether enough workers want the same thing. In San Francisco, I'm Shireen Adil for Cross Currents.
And that's our gig show for today. But before we go, we'd love to hear from you. Are you a part of the gig economy? Do you work a bunch of odd jobs to make ends meet? If so, what do you like or dislike most about juggling several jobs at once? Call us at 415-264-7106. That's 415-264-7106. Our team includes Hanat Baba, Olivia Henry, Lucy Kang, Jurgen Klemm, Angela Johnston, Lisa Morehouse, James Rollins, Stephen Short, Judy Silber, Kovalroop Kaur Singh, Andrew Stelzer, and Bowen Wang. Today's show was produced by Shireen Adil and engineered by Chris Hoff. Line producer was Liza Veal. Jen Chien is our managing editor. Ben Trefney is our news director. Our opening theme music is by the John Santos Quintet. For Cross Currents, I'm Julie Kane.